Well, boys and girls, yes, that's right. It's me, Peter Moonbeam. It's time for our weekly trip to Storyland. Tonight, we are going to Fairyland. This is perhaps the most interesting part of all of Storyland. Here in the land of fairies, everything is possible and anything can happen. It is a place of imagination and wishes. But it's hard to describe a place like Fairyland, so boys and girls, let's just go there. Tonight, a princess by the name of Kay will tell us one of the stories that she has learned from the other fairies. Now, remember how we go? Everybody climb under your stars, close your eyes real tight, and think about what a sky looks like when it is filled with stars. Somebody isn't thinking hard enough. That's better. Now wish. Wish real hard. And whee! Away we go. Come on, boys and girls. Follow me.
Boys and girls. Hi, Peter. Come on in out of the cold. I am glad that you could join me tonight. You can leave your stars just outside the door. They'll be quite safe there. Everybody get settled, because I am going to tell you about the wild swans. Once there lived a king who had 11 sons and one daughter named Lisa. He loved them all well and played with them often. They were lucky children. But their happiness didn't last. Their father married a queen who hated children. As soon as she could, she sent Lisa to live with a farmer. She told lies about the boys and blamed them for everything, until soon the king didn't care for his sons at all. One day, the queen sent for the boys. She said,
"Boys you are, but birds you'll be. Fly away, wretched creatures."
The boys turned into 11 splendid white swans. They opened their great wings and flew out of the window with a strange, sad cry. Up they went, cloud high, far and far. Lisa wasn't allowed out of the farmhouse. She had no toys or friends. Year after year went by, and she had nothing to do but look out of the window and sing to the roses. She read in the prayer book and said, "Book, what is as good as you?" The wind in the book sang, "Lisa is as good," and it was true. When Lisa was 15, the king wanted to see his daughter again. The queen still hated Lisa's goodness and beauty, but she knew that the king wanted to see the child once more. She would have turned her into a swan if she had dared. Instead, she mixed a muddy, stinking stain. She smeared Lisa's face, arms, and hair with it. Then she brought Lisa to the king. When he saw the smelly, splotchy girl, he said, "She is no daughter of mine." The queen threw Lisa out. Lisa wandered through a forest, thinking of her brothers. She didn't know they were swans. She hoped to find them somehow. Night came. Lisa lay down to sleep, whispering a prayer. Fireflies hung like jewels on the bushes, sparkling in the dusky air. When Lisa woke, the sun was up. Birds sang. She found a pond and drank. When she saw the reflection of her face and arms, she cried out in horror. She scrubbed herself hard until she was clean again. Now she was hungry. She knew the earth is full of good things to eat if only one looks. She found an apple tree and had a good breakfast. Lisa walked on through the quiet forest. By nightfall, she was tired. At the forest's far edge, she lay down and slept deep. Lisa waked with the sun. A woman came by with a bucket of raspberries. She gave some to Lisa.
"Please, have you seen 11 princes anywhere?" asked Lisa.
"No, but I've seen 11 crowned swans in the river near here," said the woman.
She led Lisa to a high river bank. From it, they could see the sea in the distance. The woman left Lisa there. Lisa wondered where to look first. Bits of glass and stone edged the river. The water had worn them smooth. The river never stops. With patience, it changes everything it touches. I'll be patient as a river. I'll look forever. I'll find my brothers. She went down to the river toward the sea. Toward sunset, she found 11 swan plumes. High and far overhead, she saw a gleaming white streak that came closer as she watched. Soon she could make out the broad, windswept of 11 swans. She hid in a clump of bushes. The swans settled on the river bank with the clatter of their big wings. The moment the sun set beyond the sea, the swans rose up from their feathers and changed into men. They were Elise's 11 brothers. She came to them with a happy cry. They hugged her and cried for joy. What a good talk they had, all of them together once again. They told each other all about their adventures.
"We're swans by day," the eldest brother told her. "At sundown, we become men. We have to be on solid ground at dark. If we were flying at the moment of change, we'd fall down to earth. We don't live here all the time. Only once a year, for 11 days, we are allowed to visit our own land. This is the happiest visit ever, for we found you, Lisa."
"Where do you live the rest of the year?" Lisa asked.
"Beyond the sea. We need 2 days to fly across. We'd never manage the trip if it weren't for a rock that lies halfway across the sea. It's just big enough for us to spend the night on. In bad weather, we have to huddle close together. But it's been safe so far."
"When do your 11 days end?" asked Lisa.
"In 2 days. I wish you'd come with us," said the eldest.
"Oh, if only you could keep your own bodies forever." Lisa woke the next day to the beating of wings. Her brothers, swans once more, were flying off for the day. The youngest stayed behind. He couldn't talk, but he and Lisa looked at the world and were together. At evening, the others came back. The sun set. They became men again.
"Little sister, how brave are you? Tomorrow we leave here. Will you let us fly you over the sea?"
"Oh, yes. Oh, gladly." All night they worked. They wove a net of boughs and vines. At daybreak, the brothers became swans again. Lisa lay in the net. The swans took its edges in their beaks and flew off with it. The youngest swan flew overhead to keep the sun out of Lisa's eyes. She slept a while. When she woke, she ate the berries she had brought. There was nothing but water below, wherever Lisa looked. The swans flew slower than usual, with Lisa to carry. By late afternoon, Lisa was worried. She couldn't see the rock they must reach before dark. A stormy wind blew up. Lightning flashed. The sun was at the sky's very rim, and still Lisa saw no rock. She whispered a prayer for the brothers and for herself, sure that they were lost. But just as the sun set, she saw the rock beneath, and as darkness fell, her feet touched solid ground. A minute later, her brothers were standing tall around her with linked arms. The rock was just big enough to hold them. A storm raged, but the 12 held tight and sang. The night went fast because they were brave. By dawn, the storm had ended. The air was clean and fresh. With Lisa in her net once more, the swans flew on. At noon, Lisa saw the shores of a country quite like her own. At sunset, the swans alighted near a wood. At once, they turned into men and took Lisa to a green grotto where she could sleep.
"I wonder what you'll dream tonight," said the youngest brother.
"Oh, I hope I dream how to save you," she answered. Lisa did dream. In her dream, she met a woman. The woman was queenly, yet somehow she seemed like the woman who had given Lisa the raspberries in the wood and had told her about the 11 crowned swans. The woman said,
"You can save your brothers. Have you courage and patience? If you do try to save them, no one will understand you. You'll be tired, alone and afraid. Here's what you must do. Near this grotto grow many nettles. They burn and sting like fire if you touch them. You must pick every last one. Only these nettles, or nettles that grow in cemeteries, will do this work. Pick them, crush them, and spin them into a green thread. Then knit 11 coats. The moment you put the coats on your brothers, they'll be free from their spell. The hardest part is this. From start to finish, you must work without speaking. If you say one word, it will be like plunging a knife into your brothers' hearts. They will die. Remember."
Lisa woke, and she began gathering nettles at once. They burned and stung and blistered her hands until they were red and sore. But she kept on. She was determined to free her brothers. She kept crushing the nettles and spinning the green thread all that day. When her brothers came that night, they saw her hard at her work. She shook her head, a finger on her lips. They knew then that she was trying to help them. She was in such a hurry, she worked all night. Next day, she kept on working. She had made one coat and part of a second, when suddenly she heard the sound of hunters' horns. She bundled the nettles up and ran into the grotto. Hunting dogs barked nearer and nearer and burst into the grotto. Huntsmen followed them. The handsomest hunter was the king of that country.
"How did you get here, lovely child?"
he asked. She shook her head. She longed to speak, but she knew that one word would kill the swans.
"Come with me," said the king. "If you're as good as you are lovely, I'll make you my queen."
He set her before him on his horse. She wept, but he held her firm on his horse.
"It's for your own good, little one," said the kind king. "Don't cry. I'll make you happy."
Lisa did not dare speak. The king led her into the palace. His maids cared for Lisa and dressed her royally. She was so perfectly lovely that everyone who saw her loved her.
Only the archbishop shook his head and muttered, "She's from the wild wood. She's too beautiful. She must be a witch."
No one listened to him. The king sat next to her at dinner. They watched a ballet. They walked through the gardens where fountains danced in the flower-scented air. But Lisa could think only of her brothers and her nettles, and she wept. Then the king showed her a room next to his own. He had it made just for her. It was hung and painted to look just like the green grotto where he had found her. On the ground was the bundle of nettles and the coats that she had knitted, just as she had left them when the hunters came.
"See, little one, this is to remind you of the hardships you've left behind. I hope to make you happier here," said the king.
The sight of the nettles made Lisa feel better. She smiled and kissed the good king's hand. He believed it was a sign of love. He ordered the bells to be rung to announce his engagement. The archbishop was still muttering, but no one paid him heed, and next day Lisa married the king. She couldn't say a word, but love for the king's kind heart shone in her eyes. She was crowned his queen with much rejoicing. Lisa longed to confide in her husband, but she knew that she could not. Each night, secretly, she slipped from her bed and knitted the coats for her brothers. When she'd made 7 coats, she had no more nettles. "Oh, I must go to the cemetery. Only cemetery nettles will do," she remembered. Though she was afraid, she went to the cemetery. The moon made weird shadows across the graves. Lisa was sure witches hid in those shadows, and she was frightened. But she said a prayer and bravely gathered the nettles. Then she hurried back as quickly as she had left. She thought no one knew she'd been out. But the sly, jealous archbishop had seen her. Now he was sure Lisa was a witch. He told the king. At first the king would not believe him.
"Why don't you watch her?" sneered the jealous archbishop. "See if she goes there again."
Doubt touched the king's heart. He hated to spy, but he hoped he'd be able to see the archbishop and tell him how silly he was. For several nights, he only pretended to be asleep. He saw Lisa get up and go to her little grotto room. Her work was almost done. 10 coats were ready, but she had no more nettles. She would have to go once more to the cemetery. The idea terrified her, but she set her will to it for her brother's sake. That night, when Lisa went to the cemetery, the king and the archbishop were following. They saw the witches gathered in the shadows. The king looked no more. He ran home, full of love and despair. He was sure that his beloved Lisa must be a witch. He wept. "She must burn at the stake. It is the law." Poor Lisa was put into a dungeon. Her bed was the bundle of nettles and the finished coats. She needed no more to be content. Near sunset time, a shadow of wings fell across the jail window. It was a swan. Her youngest brother had found her. Now Lisa was calm, and she continued her work all through the night. She must burn for it. But the coats were almost done, and her brothers were at hand. She'd save them yet. An hour before dawn, the brothers went as princes to the king, but they were not allowed to see him.
"It's too early. The king still sleeps," said the guard.
They kept trying until dawn. Then 11 swans flew sadly away. Crowds came to the city gates to watch the witch burn at the stake. Lisa was brought out in a cart. Even then, she did not leave her work. The 11th coat was almost done. It lacked only a sleeve.
"Oh, see the witch! She's still messing with her dirty magic," yelled the mob.
They started to crowd around the cart to take the work from her hands. Then, down from the sky, came 11 white swans and settled in a ring around the cart. Minnie murmured, "It's a sign of purity. She must be innocent." But they did not say the words aloud. The executioner stopped the cart, ready to take Lisa. She stood up and tossed the coats over the swans' heads. Immediately, they became 11 splendid princes. The youngest had one arm and one swan's wing, for Lisa hadn't had time to finish the sleeve.
"Now I may speak. I'm innocent," she cried.
The people crowded around gladly to hear her story, but she faded away, too worn out to speak. Her elder brother told the story for her. As he spoke, there came the scent of millions of roses. Every log laid about the stake had taken root. Bushes sprang up and burst into a riot of red roses. Above the red roses swayed one rose that was star white. The king picked it and put it in Lisa's hands. She opened her eyes, and joy filled her heart. All the bells in all the churches in the land rang out of their own accord. Flocks of singing birds winged in on every side. No king ever had so splendid a celebration as nature made for Lisa and her lord that day.
That was lots of fun, Kay. We thank you very much for telling us the story. Well, it's time for us to say goodbye, and time for all these boys and girls to be going back to their own homes. All right, boys and girls, climb back on your stars, close your eyes, and wish. Go on, wish, and whee, away we go. Well, here we are back in America. I hope you had fun on our trip and that you enjoyed the stories. I hope you will be here at your radio next week at this same time so that you can journey with us on our next story time trip. I think next week will be especially fun. Until then, be good, have fun, take care of your stars, and good night. The readers for tonight's program are Kay Boyd and Jewel West. The engineer was Witty Woonson. The selection for this evening was The Wild Swans by Hans Christian Andersen, from the book The Fairy Tale Book by Marie Ponson, published by Simon & Schuster in New York. Storytime is produced by the Mike Club, student radio organization at Mary Washington College, in cooperation with this station, and was tape recorded in advance at the College Radio Center. Your producer for tonight's story time was Quincy Carter.
Escaped. The reason I read this is that in these marginal countries, some of which will be countries that the Peace Corps is operating, this is the type of opposition they have. Do you still, after listening to that, feel that building the bridges is in the long run the real way? That's a loaded question, isn't it?
Don't we have other agencies to deal with this sort of thing? To me, the Peace Corps is not set up as an opposition force to guerrilla warfare. In fact, President Kennedy is now establishing or making the first steps towards the establishment of a guerrilla force or a stronger guerrilla force. As Mary Lou said earlier, the Peace Corps is a personal contact sort of agency. We will undoubtedly have to answer questions, and I think most of the people will be faced with incidents that they have no idea how to deal with until they're faced with them, despite the strength of any training program we can set up. I think that proficiency in dealing with these will come only with the experience, but I don't really believe that our people will be expected or will be called upon to deal in direct opposition, no matter how much indirect opposition they will have to provide to people of this nature. I think that other agencies of the United States are set up for that purpose. If Peace Corps people got mixed up in this and the involvement was exposed, I think it would spoil the whole effort and almost make certain a lack of success in the program.
Joanne?
I was going to say, don't you think it would be good propaganda and a good way for Russia, though, to really get the thing in hot water if they put the opposition like that right before us? I mean, you run up against a wall, you can't very well say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with it and turn away. I mean, you're going to be in such a position sometimes that you're going to have to make a decision and do something and not turn your back on it.
But it's still...
Well, I didn't mean for us to get too far afield. I read this only because this can occur, as both of you point out. It has to be, or will have to be, dealt with one way or another in these marginal countries in order to get the bridges built, even though I think that you are all in agreement that building the bridges, helping grow the crops, the things that Mary Lou mentioned, are the purposes of the Peace Corps. But it's going to take some tough people to do it, isn't it? I'd like to ask, is anyone here planning to participate in the Peace Corps?
Why, yes, I would like to. After I've received my degree, I would like to teach in Africa, in Nigeria. I feel that's the only thing I could do would probably teach English, but I understand they prefer you to have some extra abilities, so I'm going to try and get a nursing degree along with it. But even then, I don't know if I'll be qualified, because, like you say, it takes a great deal of strength, and they're more interested, I feel, right now in the farming elements of the program, since so much of the world is still in the agricultural stage of development.
Joyce?
I would like to say right here that they were saying that the people who go over are going to have to be flexible, because they may go over with the idea that they are going to teach.
Yes.
And then when they get over there, for some unknown reason, that position has been filled, and they may have to go out in the fields and work, or they may have to be in the home. And so flexibility is one thing that they're definitely going to need, and one reason why a more highly trained person maybe could meet the needs a little better.
Let me ask you another loaded question. Do you three students feel that American students are tough enough to do this job?
I think we have some who are. Most of them aren't, but they can toughen themselves. The ones who are really dedicated and really interested in the program can do it.
I was pleased at Mary Lou's grin over here. She's already made up her mind.
Oh, I think I agree with Sue again. It's hard to say what the American students are like. The more I think about it, the less I know about them.
Mary Lou, I think you're underestimating yourselves, which is probably much better than the American habit of overestimating ourselves. Now, I feel very strongly that young Americans are tough enough to handle this job. I was about your age in 1940 and 41, and nobody thought we were tough enough for the job. The newspapers were filled with stories about young Americans being too soft. Well, it wasn't true then, and it isn't true now. Our biggest danger is not that the young people who will participate in the Peace Corps need more knowledge of America, or even more knowledge of communism in order to combat it. Our danger is that these young Americans will not know and value the beliefs, virtues, and the way of life of the foreign people that they will live and work with. Now, I predict that if Americans gain this knowledge of the other fellow's point of view, understand it, and appreciate it as a way of life from the foreigner's point of view, then the Peace Corps will succeed. If we do not learn, then it can only be partly successful, if at all. Time's run out, but I would like to thank the members of today's discussion group, Mary Washington College students Mary Lou Sanchez, Sue Ollinger, and Joyce Lyons. Thank you very much.